The speaker tonight at the fourth annual interim lecture series is Ms. Pat Ballinger, who is a Leak Lake Chippewa. I should say that the fourth annual interim lecture series is funded in part by the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Ms. Ballinger is executive director of the American Indian Mental Health Workers Program. She's chairman of the board of the St. Paul AIM. She's chairman of board of the Red Schoolhouse. She's chairman of board of the United Indian Group Home. She also works with a group called Abenuji Center. And the title of her lecture will be A Native American Look at the Meaning of Family.
Hi, I guess I'm not tall enough for one of these systems, so I'll sort of have to stretch a lot tonight. When we talked about doing this series, and when we talked about all the different things that we could talk about, what you have to learn to sort of know what American Indian is, everything gets back to a couple of real basic things. And as much lecturing as we do around the cities, around the country, we still have to stop and explain super basic things, and I guess that's one of the things that I'm going to be doing tonight, sort of explaining one of them. A couple of them are like our religion, which is a bit different. We have to talk about the family way of life, which is a bit different. We have to talk about the governmental way of life of Indian people, which is a bit different than non-Indian. So there's a whole lot of things that have to be explained sort of basically all the way along. And I think the whole series that you're getting is a fantastically well-organized series. You've got people coming in for all different parts of the thing, which is beautiful. And my part, because I do work with Indian children, with Indian families, I have for years, that I guess I was the one picked for to do one of the very basic ones, and that's Indian family, because everything extends from that. Everything extends from certain things in the Indian community, and Indian family is one of them. So it's going to be kind of basic. If you have any question along the way, you know, if I'm not explaining something enough, go ahead and stop me. Just raise your hand. Don't wait until later. Maybe we better clear something up right away. So just go ahead. Feel free to ask a question. A few things down in front, you can sort of wander down at whenever you want to and take a look at it. I was just showing some of the kids what a few of the pictures were and a few of the things that I had with, because it's important that you see them in your head, see them with your eyes as well as seeing them with your mind. So that's why I brought them along. The family, you know, I'm going to get right down. How much time do I have? Good.
Up to 8:30,
that's all. Okay. I'll have to talk fast. Okay, then I better get going. We talk about the Indian family, you know, I'm going to just keep referring it to as it's easier to talk about the white world. Not necessarily mean just white people or all white people, but sort of the majority or the big view, you know, of what a family is. So I'm going to make comparisons so that you can see it a little better using that term, white world. But don't get confused. That's not a super racist term, except tonight I need to explain something fast. The Indian community, you know, we talk about family and the non-Indian community. A family, according to welfare department, according to the labor department, according to everybody that commands you, says the family is, you know, the children, the parents, and that's about it. You know, the grandparents become sort of off in the distance, the aunts and uncles and everything, sort of become disconnected. They have their own core family group. Indian people don't think that way. And it creates more problems than anybody realizes, because you're in order to legislate that way, you do break into the family, to the family structure by doing that. I guess my first example of that would be, for instance, like if you have to live in public housing, most Indian people can't afford to live in a nice house with 4 or 5 bedrooms, enough to take care of your family, let alone the aunts and uncles that come along with our families, the grandparents, the friends who are really part of our family now. I have brothers and sisters who aren't even of the same tribe that I am, but that does not necessarily mean that they're not my brother or my sister or my uncle or my aunt. So our family gets larger and larger as we continue talking. I have a book down here called Henry Greencrow Visits the Schools. It's written as the way Henry speaks looks rather like elementary type language. It's written that way because we use it in the schools, but it's also, you know, we use it in our high schools, and I even use it in colleges. So it's got a lot of information in it that most people don't know anyway. But Henry, in this thing, if you go through the pictures, every one of those pictures is part of his family. Henry had a birthday party for one of his children, and over 100 people showed up. And out of that 100 people, there wasn't one person that wasn't part of his family. So that's a family for you. So when I begin to talk about family, we mean a different thing than most people think of as family, you know, because when you talk about a brother or a sister getting in trouble, or your parent, you know, something happening to one of your parents, they have a car accident and land in the hospital, you immediately rush down there and you take care of that person. Or if a child is in trouble, everybody, you know, within that family gathers. Well, that's the same thing that we do, except it's on a bit of a larger scale. Henry's always busy that way with that many people in his family. But it's that sort of a concept that we have to live with, that you have to live with. If you ever work in any kind of a human service system, agency, you know, like welfare, corrections, anything, that you really have to deal with that, especially living in Minnesota. The major minority is Indian people in the state. There are more Indians than there are any other minority. So you really, if you're gonna work with it, you should understand some of it. Now, getting back now to the family thing, you know, we talk about people coming down and sharing or involving themselves. We do it even more than most people. The sharing concept becomes very important in the Indian community. It's taken me 5 years to be able to explain that, because it's always been just a part of life, and it's really hard. It's like trying to explain what breathing is to you, you know, where you go, you know, what does it do and everything, you know. But it's a hard thing to explain, because you don't have to explain what breathing is. Everybody breathes, you know. But the sharing thing in the Indian community is the same thing, you know. It after you get out of the Indian community, I lived on a reservation until I was 18, and then coming into the cities, it was hard to explain those differences. And so this is where we sort of ran into problems. We sort of began to start stuttering and stammering around. Exactly what are we talking about? Well, for instance, an Indian person can feel like I can go back home and go up to Leech Lake Reservation, or back home I can go to Red Lake Reservation, I can go to White Earth Reservation. Any of those is back home to me. My own reservation is more back home than the others, but the others I feel just as comfortable in. I can go anywhere in that reservation and be welcome just with open arms and, you know, come on in and you know, come and sit down and you know, if you got a place to stay tonight, no, you're not staying anyplace else, you're staying here. And this sort of attitude is all the time. I've been to, like, all over the country. I've been in Washington, you know, New York, all over. And always all I have to do is find where there's some Indians. And that's relatively easy to do in almost any city. There's a few ways of finding out. You know, look for a thing called an Indian center. You check with the drivers of the cabs and stuff, where the Indians go and everything. You find out one way or another. And after I do that, I don't have to stay in a hotel. You know, I might be staying with a somebody from a Kickapoo reservation. I might be staying with a Hoopa Indian from California. I might end up in, you know, in any kind of, you know, any other tribe, any other nation's home, somebody from another nation, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I become part of that family, just like that. Particularly if it's, you know, if I stay there for a while. So that extended family thing is beyond even anybody's form of notion of what a family is. Creates problems, you know, like I, during the trials, when the new trials and everything that were in St. Paul, you know, there might have been 15 or 20 people staying at my house. Well, my mother lives with us, my kids and everything, and whoever else is staying. And at that time, we had a couple people staying here permanently. But it's sort of a thing, you know, come in with 15 people and say, well, they'll be here for, you know, a couple of days, maybe a week. A couple of them stayed a little over a month. But, you know, we welcomed them. We didn't say, oh, I don't know where we're going to get food or I don't know where we're going to get blankets. You just say, come in and then, you know, sit down and we'll take care of you. And that attitude is one of the universal attitudes among Indian people, that sharing, that it's like a tradition. I can't think of another word that you'd have for it, things that you have to do, like etiquette, like old Emily, what's her name, post. Says it's one of the things in the Indian community that's very strong, that you have to do, that's part of your tradition. So this thing about having people come in, I don't know how many of you, you know, live at home or have lived at home. If you come in with, say, five or six people and say they're going to stay for a week, just stroll in the door, I don't know what your parents would do. I don't know what a lot of people would do if that would happen. I know there'd be, a lot of explaining to do, but not in the Indian community. It's just accepted. So that the family, the extended family, then gets larger and larger and larger. Other people are brought in and everything. Okay, now how does all that affect the people in that family? What is that, what kind of a feeling does that have? I'm going to pull it back to where the kids are. You know, I'll start with the little ones first. Okay, the little ones, the children, aren't treated like children are in the non-Indian world, the white world. An example of that is like, say a six-year-old has a birthday party. Okay, now everybody here, I think, knows what a party for six-year-old kids is, you know, birthday party. If you have a birthday party for a six-year-old child, you invite a whole bunch of six-year-old children, you know, and you take them someplace or they come and tear up the place or whatever, you know, whatever six-year-old can you imagine, I mean, you know. The Indian community doesn't do that. You have a birthday party for a six-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 32-year-old or you know, whatever age, everybody comes. You know, the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents, and then that's not just two sets of grandparents, that may be six or seven sets of grandparents. Everybody comes. There's no separation of the children from the parents at a birthday party. Everybody's there. You put the food on the table and everybody has a good time and giggling and laughing and, you know, there's a lot of socializing and everything. Bring out the drum, sing some songs, sing 49s or some of the old songs or some of the new songs somebody picked up at a powwow somewhere. Then, you know, maybe they'll have one song, they'll say, all right, this is for, you know, whoever's birthday it is. This is Tony's birthday, you know. And you say Tony, and Tony comes up and stands up there, and they'll say, well, Tony is 6 years old today, and he's done this or done that, or he goes to school or whatever, you know. And that little boy stands there, and they're holding him and telling him how good he is, you know. And then, you know, everybody comes by and shakes that kid's hand, everybody. His other cousins do. The grandparents, everybody shakes that child's hand. Then they sing a song. Everybody sings a song. They sing the old songs. This one's for Tony. You know, Tony stands there and he's proud of it. Some people give him presents, you know, but that's not necessary. But all of this is going on. See, that child isn't. You know, it hasn't become a day of separation. It's become a day where he becomes closer to the family. They hold him up and say, you know, this is somebody good. No, in any community that anybody's that, you know, respected, I guess you grow your own self. That little boy, you know, at that point, you know, feels proud, knows he's something. You don't separate him. White people have something called generation gap. Teenagers wouldn't be caught dead going to a party where their parents were. And the parents wouldn't be caught dead going to a party where their kids were. And the kids, the little ones, are left home with a babysitter, and who knows where the grandparents are. When we even do things like going to the grocery store, everybody goes together. If you come up to Minneapolis or someplace and go to a store like Target or, you know, one of the cheap shopping centers or cheap grocery stores, you go and you see an Indian person, you see an Indian mother or an Indian father or somebody, you'll find there's teenagers there and there's the little kids, probably a grandparent or two in tow, a couple aunts and uncles. Everybody goes to the grocery store. Everybody goes everywhere together. We don't have that thing called generation gap. Another example of that, if we talked a bit before this about you know, like a powwow, which is one of our great get-togethers. You see drum groups that are teenagers, 14, 15, or 18 years old. You see their fathers and their grandparents, everybody around those drums. And you see the mothers dancing and the young ones dancing, the teenagers dancing. Everybody's there together. I don't know how many times people, other nations get together that much. You know, we have problems with that. You know, if you want to go out and have a drink, you know, well, you don't, like I said, we don't get babysitters and ask everybody to stay home. One of the things Indian people always do is bring everybody along. Well, you know what the cops and the welfare workers and everybody thought about that. You know, we were abusing our children. They didn't realize we were all together, though. You know, even at the bar, you know, people aren't always good and people aren't always bad. And you learn to deal with the good, the bad, and the ugly times and the fun times and everything together, but you deal with them as a family. But that's, you know, something that's very tight in the Indian community. And it's not very tight 200 years ago. It's very tight today. So if you can grasp that, you know, what that means, they still get mad at us if we bring one of our children who's 13 or 14 or 15 into a bar with us, you know. You know what the authorities are thinking? Well, that's an unfit family. But I guess our definition of family and their definition of family are two different things. I guess nobody should be in that bar, but that's one of the realities of life. Everybody has to escape sometimes. And that's one of the great times, you know. Indian people are very social. I know you've seen pictures of us stoic Indians, and we don't laugh or cry or anything. We had a family like 2 months ago, about 2.5 months ago, that they were trying to take the kids away from the mother, and this was up in Duluth. So it meant driving back and forth between Minneapolis and Duluth, back and forth, every time the lawyers wanted to meet, every time there was court and everything, the appeals and all this stuff, you know. The mother was down here and the kids were up there. And they were trying to take those kids away from her. Well, it's a good hour and a half, 2 hour drive from Minneapolis to Duluth. That mother would cry all the way up there, and she'd cry all the way back down. But when she was in court, she wouldn't shed a tear. And our social, our psychologist that was there trying to help us represent that mother, the parent, the whole family, would say, you know, God damn it, don't cry in the car, cry in that courtroom, you know. That judge, you know, will give you those kids back if you show them. But she wouldn't. She said, I can't do it, you know, and it's, you know, I won't let them get that step ahead of me. And she didn't, and we really had to fight. In fact, that thing is still in court. But Indian people are not, they're very friendly and open amongst themselves or amongst friends or amongst family. It's very hard to live in two different worlds. It's a bicultural world to us, and it's very bicultural. There's two separate places. There's our world and there's your world, and they're very separate. And it's hard to try and walk that line between them. And you know, you try not to, there's so many things pushed at you all the time. These separations and these different laws that say thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that, that it's hard to be open, you know, to the other side as we are open amongst ourselves. So it's, you know, if you see that, don't think that they can't laugh and have a good time, because that's what we do most of. In fact, in Wounded Knee, in one of the buildings, they were out, the newspaper men from all over the country were saying that's a big put on, you know, it's not really, you know, they're not really serious or anything. Here's bullets flying every which way, and Indian people are sitting in there. There's no sense in laying on the floor, because they were such bad shots anyway that everybody was walking around. But the thing was, you know, people would just laugh and go along with business. You had to, you know, once you accepted you were there. If you were going to stay, then that's it, you know. And you had to, there's no sense in crying about it. It wasn't going to help anything. So people would just go on with life, and there was a lot of funny things happening. We thought they were funny. But the newspaper men, you know, were kept saying that it was all a put on. The whole thing was for publicity's sake. How many people dodge bullets for publicity's sake, I don't know. But that was their analysis of the whole thing from beginning to end. Because people, we could sit back and laugh while we were in amongst ourselves. You know, that was what we were doing. So it's an easygoing type life. The kids are taught from little ones to that respect, because they're showing that respect themselves. It's not a one-way respect, it's a two-way street. You have in the white community a thing called an illegitimate child. That was a new word to us. The hospitals, the white hospitals, well, it's only been probably 20 years that any of the hospitals in the Twin Cities have ever seen Indian people come in anyway. And when you have an illegitimate child, you're put off in a room by yourself, and they have this whole thing that you go through for an illegitimate child. And they couldn't understand it. All of, you know, everybody, the aunts and uncles and everybody up were looking at the kid and having a good time with it. And, you know, they, when we brought him home, put him in a Dikinagan cradle board, you know, and really honor that kid right from the time he was born. And all these non-Indian people, the nurses, everybody were really amazed. You know, they really, boy, they don't know what they're doing. That's an illegitimate child. They shouldn't be doing those things. You know, they should be ashamed of yourself. So I don't know. That's one of the things that we could never understand, why they would put labels on little ones. Well, that's the child thing, you know, I'm telling you that, you know, that everybody's respected or should be respected from the time they're little on up, and then it goes both ways. The parents, of course, are the providers. They're the providers of everything. The children are expected. Everybody takes care of everybody else in the Indian community. So if you're 6-year-old and you got a 2-year-old brother or sister, then you help take care of that 2-year-old, you know, brother or sister. If you're 11 years old, by the time you're 11 or 12, by the time our children are that age, then they're expected to be able to take full control of that child, a younger brother or sister. it's like we don't treat our children like you treat your children. You expect them to be children. You expect them not to have any sense. I remember going to a white high school where we had to stand in line and raise our hands and we, you know, all this stuff, which is ridiculous, you know. I was treated as an adult at home and having to go to school and being treated like some little kid who didn't know nothing was insulting, you know. It was very insulting to be treated that way if you can go home and plan your own life, you know. Like I could take off and go wherever I wanted to, whenever I wanted to. In fact, I didn't spend much time at home. Not because my home life was so bad, but I was just finding interesting things around, you know, different reservations. I used to go with my grandfather all over the place, come down to Twin Cities a lot. I had cousins down here and everything, and there was always these things to do down here. And so I'd come down and go back and forth. I was 9 or 10 taking the Greyhound bus. And I'd stay from maybe Friday till maybe Tuesday or Wednesday. And then come back, well, you know, the school authorities and everybody thought that was terrible. Here's this little kid running all over the place. Well, we do that. We don't have that fear. That, you know, my parents, my family knew that when I came down, you know, went another place, that somebody else would take care of me because of that extended family thing. You know, I didn't have to worry. They didn't have to worry about it. They knew I had a place to stay and somebody to watch me and everything. It's a great feeling of security. The parents are the providers of just anything you can think of. You know, that's sort of their role. But it's not just providers for their own 3 or 4 children. They're providers for anybody that's there. There might be 8 children. I don't remember ever living alone. I mean, what I mean by alone is just my brothers and my parents and me. I don't ever remember living that way. I remember there's always, we had a little bitty house, you know, the 3-room things, and there was always 2 or 3 families in there. And we didn't, you know, think it was so bad. It was a lot of fun, you know, but the fact was that we could just sort of go from one place to another. You know, I can go to any other reservation. My kids, my own children, Lisa's 14 and Michael's will be 10 this month. They've been to the Southwest by themselves without me for 3 months. This is a couple of years ago when they were a little smaller than they are now. I don't know how many of you have ever been able to do anything like that. I think going any place when you were 7 or 8 years old was a big thing. You know, you packed, you know, everybody cried for a while and things like that. But we don't do that. You know, it's if they made up their mind to go, you know, and we knew they'd be taken care of, there's nothing to stop them. The feeling that you've always got a place to come back to, or you've always got a place to go to, is extended. You know, you don't ever have to worry about a place to stay. You don't ever have to worry about somebody shutting the door in your face saying there isn't enough. People share everything. For instance, your car. Okay, I work with St. Paul AIM. And a lot of people come down and volunteer time. And like I said, we don't separate blacks from whites, from Mexicans, and from everything else. Everybody, you know, is welcome. Unless you're a Fed, stay away. But them we don't welcome. But if you come in and volunteer time, a lot of things we found, at least I found, and I was surprised, you know, I didn't know why people kept leaving, you know. And I couldn't figure it out for the longest time. They get this thing, I can't think of the word. Let me tell you one. Maybe you can think it out yourself. But anyway, people would come in and like I said, things are shared. You expect it in any community. If you're in any community, you just expect it without having to go through this big hassle. You just expect it like a car. You know, People would come in and volunteer, and we'd have all the cars out doing this one, that one, and we'd have one more person that needed something, you know, like going to the hospital or go down to welfare, go down to up to the other school or something and pick up some books, something, you know. And we needed a car, and this non-Indian person, say a white person, was sitting here and doing some things for us, would say, well, we have to take your car for a while. We'll be gone for 2 hours or 3 hours, and we'll be back. You know, we got to take this from the hospital, or we got to go and get some books, or we got to do something. And that person would say, well, gee, you know, my insurance doesn't cover you. My brakes don't work. You know, my clutch is going out. And they had all these excuses. And it didn't dawn on me for months and months and months that what they were saying is, it's my car, you know. I paid money for it. I'm responsible. It's my car. And, you know, why should I be lending it out? And I didn't even understand that. And one of them told me that was what it was. And I was surprised, you know, because to us a car gets you from here to there and back again, maybe. But that's what it is, you know. Our cars, you never know. Some pretty old rickety cars running around there. But, you know, that attitude of sharing is just there. We just expect it. And when non-Indian people come in, and if they're not used to that attitude, it's very hard for them. You know, it's hard to adjust. And they really think that they're being put on, you know, taken advantage of, I guess is the term I wanted to use. If you have money, you know, if that person needed something, if that person needed medicine, or if they needed money for food, they say, all right, how many, who's got any money? You got a dollar, you know, and go around, everybody taking money and stuff, and everybody be, you know, I got this much and that. And, you know, that was just always sort of an insult to those non-Indian people working there. You know, what are they doing taking my money? That's my money, you know, sort of an attitude. I guess that sharing thing had to do with, to us, trying to think it out in my own head. This is how I came up with it, so bear in mind, it's my own head. That sharing with us meant more than, you know, lending something out and expecting it back, because that's not really what it means. You know, it means sharing the responsibility for other people. And they don't necessarily have to belong to your own family, even your own extended family. You know, they have to be anybody that comes in the door. St. Paul AIM office, you know, we started that thing in an old church building and everything, and got the thing moving. And we ended up, like, doing an awful lot of social service type things. Somebody comes in that door and needs assistance, we try to give them that. We try not to turn them away from the door until we've helped them. We don't just say, well, you know, I'll refer you here or refer you there. We can't do that. We don't feel that that's taking any kind of a responsibility. But according to the people who give us money, it's a bad thing. You know, you have to keep all these records. You have to find out who else have to help that person, you know. You have to find out all these other things. You have to go through all these legal type things. Well, we've learned to do that enough to get away with what we do anyway and leave it at that. There's a lot of people in the Twin Cities because of the trials, and before that, you know, just a lot of residue left from the trials. A lot of people left over from that, but there's also a lot of people that are in town just because they have no place else to go. They've been in town like 3 or 4 years and haven't had a job and haven't been on welfare and haven't been in the system at all, in the public schools or something, for one reason or another, whatever that reason is. Well, we don't just say, well, I'm sorry, you know, if you don't go to welfare, you're not going to get fed, or if you don't do this or that. We just sort of move them in with another family, move them around, keep them going, you know, get them interested in things, maybe get the kids into the daycare center or into the school or into something, you know, and get them moving and get them back into, at least into the Indian community, if not into the white community. Because it's important that we take care of that segment of people too. The things that, the family things that we do, I think are all integrated in any other things that we do. We work with Stillwater Prison. We work with anybody that comes in, and not only Indian people. I sort of stress that. That's our focus, and those are the people that we understand the best, so those are the ones that we try to help the best. But if anybody else comes in there, they're never turned away either. When we talk about the family and how that structure is, and I was telling you sort of a thing that most Indian families that I know of that are good, stable families do, and I was just telling you some of the things. There are families that aren't that tight, you know. I mean, they don't know a lot of that stuff. Well, why is that? I talked to my grandparents and somebody else's grandparents and everybody else I could to find out what was wrong. You know, why were we having the alcoholic rate that we have? How come we have so many kids not in school? You know, like, we got our dropout rate in school is like above 75%, over 75%, you know, out of that many. Well, really, the ones that graduate actually get all the way through school is only like about 8 or 9%, and the rest don't make it. Well, why is it? What's going on? Find out that the generation above me, the ones that are 50, 45, 50, on up maybe to about 65, all went to BIA boarding schools. Almost everybody I went to school went to a BIA boarding school. The BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, boarding schools, have you ever had anything on that? Do you know what a BIA boarding school is? No? Yes? No? Well, Bureau of Indian Affairs have boarding schools that you live there and you go to school. The Bureau of Indian Affairs decided that's the government, you know. It's not run by Indian people. It's run by the government. The Bureau of Indian Affairs decided that Indian people, in order to make it in the non-Indian world, in order to make it in general society, had to quit being Indian. They couldn't speak their language, you know, because it's a different kind of language. The religion is considered a heathen religion. There's just a lot of things. So what they did was there was a boarding school in Flandreau, which is right across the border here. I'm not quite sure where it was. There's boarding schools in different places. There's some that are near here, and then the rest of them are like one in Montana, one in Oklahoma, one in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, or one in Pennsylvania. The name of it's Carlisle. I don't know where it is. Someplace in Pennsylvania, but. They felt that like Ojibwe kids should be sent here and here and here and here across country. Number one, to separate them. Number two, they wouldn't be close to home because Indians keep trying to get back home and go back to their families. So they tried to keep that from happening. They got them when they were very small. They still do it. It's not unknown yet. To be pulled from home into a boarding school. Usually the welfare helps in it now. The boarding schools, at that point, you were kept like for 6 or 7 years without ever going home. You know, like in the summertime, if school wasn't in session, you were boarded out to a nice white Christian home until your school started again. So these kids, you know, being 7, 8, 9 years old, were pulled away from home for a number of years, you know, maybe 4 years, maybe 8 years, and never allowed to go home. Okay, they lost their language. You know, if you don't speak it, if you're forced not to speak it, because they were threatened, punished, and really punished for doing that. Incidentally, that punishment, they want to stop him and tell you that the woman who ran the BIA boarding school in Montana, they went in on Indians' insistence only, and we finally got it through. They did a surprise visit at the one in Battle Mountain boarding school, and there were kids chained to the beds for spending. They said, well, what are you punishing for? Well, they were caught speaking their languages. That wasn't 100 years ago. That was only a couple of years ago that happened. So they removed that BIA person from that school, the one that directed the school. She is now the head of Indian education in Washington. Tells you what I think of bureaucracy. I'm not going to tell you. But that punishment thing, you know, for doing that, you know, the kids lost a lot. They came home, you know, now they're 15 or 16 years old and they come home. Well, first of all, they haven't been on a reservation for several years. And back home on the reservations, they don't have flush toilets and they don't have food like you guys know it. They don't have all these things. And it was very strange for those kids to come back into that. They couldn't talk to their grandparents and their aunts and uncles. They couldn't understand them, and the aunts and uncles and grandparents and parents couldn't understand the kids either. And so there was this division. Well, these kids then, most of them, some of them, you know, got right back in and hung right in again, and they were fine. But a lot of them couldn't do that. Okay, then they were given jobs or pushed out into the white community and couldn't really make it there either, because enough of their Indianness, you know, was left that they couldn't really become white people in the sense that I'm, you know, telling you about before, that they were sort of left out of either way. Well, they became failures. You know, they became failures in anything they tried to do. I don't know how many times people can fail before it starts getting to them, you know, until it starts breaking them down mentally, being broke down mentally in the first place in school and telling them how bad they were. You know, you were so bad, you know, you're such a bad person that you can't speak your language. You can't admit you're this or that. And now this is, I'm telling you that was one whole generation that happened to. Okay, and then they had kids. The kids couldn't speak their language. They didn't know their religion. They didn't have their own ways. But there's, like, again, in this generation, there's a lot of residue. People that, you know, we've been able to get back to the reservations. You know, some of us lived on reservations and stuff. And there was that thing. We didn't have to be kept from school, just totally, you know, kept into school and away from home. We got to make it back home and everything. The ones that were really lucky were the ones way back in the sticks that they couldn't find. They're doing fine. And I hope everybody leaves them alone. So you've got that whole thing that's just wrecking the kids. Okay, now these kids are having kids, you know, and they're sort of pulling back. They're trying to remold that Indianness that was being lost for them. When AIM started in Minneapolis, it started over police brutality and over things that were happening to people, the absolute misery they were living under. But what happened was all these people kept getting together in rooms and talking and bringing their kids and everything, and they said, well, let's have a powwow, let's do this, let's do that. And that Indianness began more and more and more. So that people who hadn't even danced since they were little kids, you know, would come back and they'd sit and watch for a while, and then pretty soon they'd come back and they'd have a shawl or they'd have something, or they'd go sit around the drum or something, and just kept building and building. So now we've got something. There's a core again. But the ones that we see with the problems, the kids that can't make it, the parents that can't make it, are still the ones that are living directly in the middle of that whole thing. You know, they're not Indian, they're not white, and they don't fit anywhere. And one of the things that happens in school, if and when they go to school, is that they're mentally being destroyed. You know, the genocide is there. Look the term up, you know. So you've got a a group of people that are having a really hard time. These are the people that we have to work with at these different offices. The daycare center we have has had like 22 kids at a time. Now we've only got 7. Welfare and its wisdom put on a new law in everybody across the country called Title 20. Everybody should look that up and everybody should know what it's doing. When Watergate happened, you know, when we found the graft and the corruption at the top, and the people were saying no more, and everybody started talking about law and order, what did the legislators do? They put it right back in your own backyard when they said, yeah, law and order. Well, how much crime is there in, you know, St. Paul? How much is there in Faribault? How much is there, you know, wherever it is? The crime rate's, you know, rising. Look at all the people that are stealing food stamps. Look at all the people that are stealing, you know, and they're going on and on. They're moving it out of their own backyard, you know. They're moving it out of the ones that are really doing the most, which is the legislators. They're moving it out of their backyard, back into our yard. And one of the things is Title 20. Title 20. People can't even get any kind of assistance on the program. So it's sort of what we're doing. But it legislated it so tight that most people can't even get any kind of assistance on the program. So it sort of wiped out, almost wiped out that daycare center, because that was one of the support systems that we saw. We had 24 kids one time. Of the 24, there were 4 of them that were what you might call, in white terms, normal and average and happy little kids. The rest of them had speech problems, they had hearing problems, they had just all different things. Kids called hyper. That the attention spans were small and everything. But working with them for, you know, a year or two, those kids are all right. But the mental distortion comes early. You know, particularly if your parents have gone through that thing and haven't been able to go one way or the other. The thing that we feel has to be done in order to make the Indian community self-dependent is to build that family structure back up, you know, to show that child that respect that I was telling you about, to show them that they have to respect the grandparents and their parents and their aunts and their uncles and everybody, you know, that you have to respect other people, that you can't be like, I hate to say this, but the only way I think of it is the way white people, white kids in school show you to be. You know, the super way to act now is to be very disrespectful of everything, which is bad. You know, there was something, you know, talk about sharing and respect and everything, and how that carries on, like with us, you know, we're still talking about family. Even the animals are part of our family. And even the, you know, everything, the trees, you know, the rocks, everything, you know, we're all related. That you have to respect that. And then they had something a while back that everybody said was a fuel shortage. And they said there was, you know, that was one of them, was that big fuel shortage you guys thought you had. The sugar shortage, you know, when they kept all that sugar in bins and said, man, there's a big shortage, until everybody quit buying sugar, then it all got back on the shelves again. But I saw something happen in the white community that I'd never seen before. People started to conserve. I saw white people, you know, trying to cook without sugar. That was the best thing that ever happened to this country, with those two shortages. I'm trying to get them to realize that there's a shortage of water. So I'd really like to see some clean water again. But that won't happen unless somebody tells you, all right, people, there is a shortage of water, I might add. The only unallocated water in this country left is on Indian land. So you know what's going to happen? We're going to get it legislated away from us, but not without a fight. One of the things that happened that sort of destroys any kind of respect we have. You know, we try to tell the kids that they have to respect everybody, you know. They have to respect everything and everybody. It's very hard when they see people not being respectful, you know. White people coming up on our reservations and shooting game and then leaving it or selling it. I mean, it just doesn't compute. I don't know what else to say. I don't know how else to say it. It just doesn't register up here. That is not what you shoot them for. That's not how you treat your brothers or your sisters. Well, I guess they do. Remember me lie. They did something there. So these things are part of a family, part of what we're talking about. I showed everybody a picture. I'm going to swing out of there. I'm going to move to another subject. I think I had a picture of something called a swing, baby swing. In school, you know, when you're 6 years old and coming into school, you know, remember you've had your family, you know, your Indian grandmother and grandparents and everybody around you, and people cooking for you and doing for you, all Indian people. You come into the school system and it's just like being here, you know. I feel very strange in this room. I know there's not too many of my kind here. But it doesn't, you know, and this is what happens when you're in school. You sort of get over that strangeness and newness and start making friends here and there and everything. And then all of a sudden it's October 12th. That's good old Columbus Day. And they start talking about Indians, you know. It's sort of embarrassing because what they bring out and what they show and what they talk about isn't really what Indian people know, what those Indian kids know that Indians are about. They're an Indian, that isn't how they are, you know, the way they show them on Columbus Day. And then after the kids just barely getting over that embarrassment and everything, you know, it's middle of August, October, and they stop talking about it, all of a sudden it's Thanksgiving Day. And they bring it out again, you know, and you cut all them little silly feathers out. They do all these things, you know, that are really embarrassing to kids. And then they don't talk about Indians anymore, you know. Then they talk about the country and everything, and all of a sudden Indians are just wiped out, you know. You don't hear about them anymore. You don't hear about Indian life, Indian family life. In a way, you're saying, you know, well, if it's not important enough to talk about, you know, you're not important enough to talk about. You sort of give that child a negative feeling from that absence of any type of explanation of their life. So then they're starting to learn how to read now. They're a little taller. They're learning. Any child psychologist will tell you that our kids are learning as fast as your kids at that rate. They're equal then. They're a little older. It begins to change. So by the time they're in fifth or sixth grade, they've almost stopped learning completely. From then on, it's just being pushed from grade to grade, you know, just pushed through school. While you're 13, you got to get them out of here before, you know, you can't put them in. If they're 13, even if they don't know how to read or write or do anything, you know, you can't just leave them back in whatever X grade they were in. But anyway, this kid is just learning how to read. And they talk about Dick and Jane and, you know, whatever those kids' names, Sally and then mother and father, and it shows this really neat house and everything, and you know all those stereotypes and what that does. But also, you know, they have, let's say, for instance, they bring home a new baby. This is baby, and it's a brother. Then they show you how to spell brother on the board, brother, you know, or sister, whatever it is. And then they show them the baby in a crib. And then you know how they, in the story, they bring everybody in to see my new baby brother, you know. Look how he cries, and that's how you spell cry, or whatever they do. But anyway, the thing is, you know, that a lot of our kids don't use a crib. They use a swing. And I sort of showed people pictures of it. So I guess somebody explained it like a hammock. We do that and because, you know, when you're pregnant, before the baby's born, it's moving all the time, you know. And when you're born, like in a hospital, they bring you out in a bright light and they lay you on the table, you know. And then you get put in on them little boxes and things. And it's on a hard surface and you're covered with a blanket and that's it, you know. And then you take them home, and you put them in a crib, and it's this big space, and it's a little baby, and it's bars. I don't know why you put your kids behind bars anyway at such an early age, and wonder what happened. That's the first thing they see and remember, them silly bars. But we don't do that. You know, we think that's cruel to do that to a child. That you remember, you always bring people back to what they remember. You know, that you give them security and comfort by putting them. So we put them, we wrap our babies tight. We try not to put them on a hard surface and under a bright lights or anything, because they're not used to that. You know, they were inside where it was warm. Can you put them in a swing, and the swing sits over the bed. You know, just you put a couple nails or something, you know, hooks and a clothesline, and then you take a blanket and you put it in there, and then a board. There's a picture down here if you want to come down and look at it. It's sort of, it's hard to explain. But it's just a swing, and you push, you know, the baby rocks that thing. Well, okay, what we're doing is bringing that baby back to what it remembers. You know, when it goes to sleep, it's got that rhythm again, you know. It feels comfortable in there. And we keep that baby in that swing until it wants to get out. That might be when he's two, it might be when he's three. I know kids that slept in the swings for until they were about three, but then by then we have to get him out because the swings aren't big enough anymore. Unless you throw a hammock up. We wrap them tight and we put them in that swing, you know. That gives them a sense of security, of remembrance. And you bring them out of it gradually. When they're awake, you know, they're up and with you and playing, and you keep them with you all the time. When our kids aren't as... they're quieter kids. You know, they don't cry as much. They don't... they're not demanding. And a lot of that is because of the way we treat them when they're babies. We don't pressure them a lot, you know. We allow them to choose their own time to potty train themselves. You know, your kid isn't retarded if he hasn't learned to potty train himself by the time he's three, really, you know. Maybe he just likes to feel being wet, I don't know. But the thing is, you know, that you allow them to develop, you know, in their own rhythm. And also that you teach them even at that age, you know, your brothers and sisters are as important to you as your parents and your grandparents and your aunts and uncles. We had a family that the mother, one of the older daughters, had a baby and then broke her leg coming out of the hospital, so she had to go right back to the hospital. It was a real bad break and everything. And so the mother had to go up north to take care of that new baby and the daughter for like a month. Okay, the oldest child that she had was 12, and the youngest was about 6 or 7. And unfortunately, they were on welfare. The father was back on a reservation. So these kids were sort of left to home alone for a month. Well, in the first place, they weren't really alone. It was a housing project, and there was a couple of their aunts and uncles and very close friends living all the way around them within the, you know, like five houses. You know, the one on one side of them was the one in the, you know, they were all family or very good friends. And those kids had more fun that month than I think they ever had, because, you know, they sort of went around, saw what everybody's having for supper, and they'd pick the one they wanted to go to, and they'd all eat over there that night and the next day. And there was always somebody there with them at bedtime. I mean, they never just went home, went to bed. There was always one of those people, you know, that were in the immediate vicinity there with them. They took them home. They took the little ones home. How would you like to come over with our children, you know, and they made sure that those kids were taken care of. Well, Charlotte knew that. You know, she knew her children weren't, you know, just abandoned, because she wouldn't do that anyway. But it was also very important for her to get back to that, because they lived way out, to that other child that needed her help right then. The welfare tried to take the kids. First of all, they weren't in school. Those kids never did go to school. I'll get back to that later, but they were left by themselves for a month. We had to fight in court for months and months and months to keep those kids together with their family, with their mother. That family is a very strong Indian family. one of the girls is back home married now and, you know, kind of all the family and everything. One of them is in school at Haskell Institute. Another one is, they're all doing fine, you know, it's just keeping them from the welfare for a while. But they didn't go to regular school. They've never been able to go to regular school. There are some of those kids that can't adjust to the type of environment. They're very Indian family, even though they live in the cities. They're very traditional people. And just couldn't adjust in a school situation. Well, luckily we started the Red Schoolhouse. That family's been in that school for, you know, since the start. And then that's when the welfare got off their backs, because at least they were going to school somewhere. Those kids have been sort of the backbone of a lot of things that happened. The youth group, they were the backbone of that. They were always there. You can always count on them. That's one of the places you can go if you really need a place to stay. I don't care who you are. You know, it's that kind of a family. So we thought it was a successful family, still feel that way. And this has been like 5 or 6 years now that we've been working with that family, or they've been working with us, as a matter of fact. But, you know, it was a successful, what we thought as a successful family. And yet the welfare thought that was one of the worst families they'd ever seen, you know. So that family thing is very strong in the Indian community. You have to understand that sort of a feeling before you can almost understand anything. I won't get into Indian religion or anything, because you've got some great people coming in to talk about that. You should listen very carefully. A lot of things that a lot of people are searching for are right there, in you know, right in your backyard. You don't really have to, you know, change your whole way of anything, but there are certain things that you have to learn. One of them is respect. I think that people have to teach their children that. And that people have to understand that if this was an Indian meeting, if we were having an Indian meeting here, there as many people there are here, there'd be at least double that. And why I'm saying that is everybody bring their kids. There'd be teenagers sitting on the back wall over there and wandering around. There'd be little ones here, grandparents, you know, they might be wandering around. But that's the difference, you know, the whole family would be there. You should learn that. You should learn to respect your family, you know. Learn to get everybody together, keep everybody together. I guess that I'm not saying that maybe that's the very best way to live, but we found it to be a great way, you know. We don't see that as a bad thing. We have a group home is a residential treatment center for disturbed juveniles. We've got a girls' home and a boys' home, another boys' home opening up shortly. But like they're, all these kids that have been taken away, you know how many kids have been taken away, Indian kids have been taken away in the state? Uh, 39% of all Indian kids have been taken away from their families. Some of it's good, but most of it's not. And when they take them away, you know, when you start dealing with the workers, the welfare workers and the courts and everything, the thing we always say is, you know, well, if they can't stay with their own family, let them stay with their grandparents, or let them stay over here, that, so they can visit and everything. And that's the most shocking thing we've ever said to a welfare worker. What do you mean that family is no good for that child, you know? And then we're getting this big hassle. Well, the group home is having a very hard time existing. It's existed for 5 years. They tried to take away the license again this year. They got a new worker up there who came in and said, well, you know, everybody's alike, not everybody's different. You know, Indians aren't different from everybody else. And you're discriminating by putting this kind of a treatment thing in there. And all we're doing is saying that, you know, that our ultimate goal for each one of the children is whether or not they go home. And we have to teach them to live, you know, to be able to cope with their own problems, and then to be able to recognize their family's problems and live with it, you know, maybe help them if they can, but at least live with it. that there are other people out there that care for him and try to get him, you know, successful that way. I mean, we've done a great job at that group home, you know, but they're still trying to wipe it out or change it so it's more white-oriented. But those kids, you know, one of the things that we constantly do is try to bring the families in or bring anybody's family in so those kids have some family, somebody's family to look at and to be friends with and everything. And there's babies there constantly and little kids. And there's all sorts of people coming in and out of that group home. When we try to do that, when the workers are coming, we try to hide everybody. Because that's not what a group home is supposed to be. Again, I see that you're building in that generation gap, you know, again. White people do amazing things. I know one of the things that they did that just amazes me and freaks me out is they got a new culture now. It's a high-rise culture. You get all the grandparents, you know, and you put them all separate, away from everybody else. I don't know why you did that. And I don't know why anybody supports it, but I think that's the worst thing anybody's ever heard of. That whole thing of separation is there. I guess I say that we want help and we're looking for help and we're trying to do things, you know. But look to your own, you know. There's a lot of things that in order to help us, you have to help yourself. In order for you to understand us, you have to understand yourself. I brought a lot of things along that could help you. One of them is that book. I said, you know, people could come down and look at it before class and stuff. Some of you did. That's fine. And the name of the book is Indian and Free. Maybe you can get it at the library. Make them buy it here for the library so you could look at it when you wanted to. But it's just a picture of just sort of a life on a reservation. It's using Red Lake Reservation. And that wasn't 100 years ago. This guy is still around taking pictures. You know, this is now, today. He's done it in an urban setting. The only difference is, you know, you can see streetlights and stuff out there. Other than that, it's the same. It's very important that you understand that Indian people aren't trying to completely separate themselves from anybody else. That's not true. But it would be good for people to learn respect and to learn to respect one another and one another's differences so that, you know, that my neighbors, for instance, don't get all excited and call the cops every time they see, you know, 12 or 13 people coming out of my house in the morning. And I'm not really running a crap game or anything, you know, that's just people staying overnight. You know, but makes them nervous to see that many Indians or non-Indians, you know, it's not just a place for Indians to stay. The paper, the name of that thing on the board is Akwe Sasni Notes. It's sort of our national newspaper. A lot of things in there are political to Indian people. I think everybody should read it, but then, you know, you haven't got time to do that sometimes. But the paper is sort of a encapsulated thing of what's happening today in the Indian community, all over the country. It's important that you get the perspective of where, you know, what we're living in, because we're living in that world too. You know, we're living in this world, but we're living in that world too. For people, particularly college kids, you know, particularly people that are going to go out and eventually get jobs where they would have to be in contact or be assistants to Indian people, you should learn a little bit about what's going on, about other people, you know. One of the things that this state did was invited a lot of Vietnamese in. I don't see that as bad. I think that people should understand them a little more, you know, before they start doing so many things for them. One of the first things they did was immediately put together just hundreds of bicultural, multi-language classes. You know, they all of a sudden, you know, there's people being taught Vietnamese, and these kids are being taught, you know, those kind of classes. You know, for the last 6 years, I've been writing proposals to the state education department, trying to get a bicultural, bi-language class for some of the kids that we have to work with, and it's never happened. You know, but let a few other people come in and zap, they got it. We're going to learn Vietnamese. Maybe we can figure out a way to get some of that. But the thing that is, you know, sticks in my mind and all of that frustration and that struggle that we go through to try to keep our own family life together, to try to keep our own, to get our own people to the point where they'll come to a class like this, is a long and bitter struggle, because most non-Indian people refuse to listen. You know, I'd like to see some of the comments of this class. We did this for some welfare workers, in fact, all of the welfare workers in St. Paul, on a mandatory thing, because we put a good discrimination thing on them. And I said, well, we could take you to court, or we could just settle it by you having some of your workers listen and try to learn. And while we brought them to the AIM office, to the Red Schoolhouse, and the thing that most of them wrote about, you know, when we asked for evaluations of the classes, was that, number one, it was too noisy. There were people wandering in and out of class. We had some dogs in there, you know. It was those kind of comments, you know, nothing about the content of the thing, which was disturbing, because they weren't really looking at the thing. Does anybody have any questions? Well, there was a lessening of those bonds because of the BIA boarding schools. Now we don't have to put our kids in the boarding schools unless the welfare gets in there. Sometimes, you know, they get their hands on them, and then that happens. But most of our people now are free to kind of travel back and forth between reservations and non-reservation to reservation, so that, you know, that that's not as acute as it was. Anything else? Okay, I'm not gonna stop. I'm gonna switch subjects a bit. I'm gonna tell you something that's going on now that's sort of happening that you have to understand in order to understand what's going on in the community. The churches, the people in the United States are suddenly realizing. A lot of people have understood and realized before, but I guess the word is legally recognized that there's problems in the United States. One of them is hunger, that there are people that are actually hungry in this country. That's really true, honestly, it really is. I don't know if anybody's ever thought about it, but there are a lot of people in this country that are starving. And so for the first time in the history of this country, the churches have gotten together and said there's hunger in the United States. They put together, through the National Council of Churches, a thing called the Domestic Hunger Campaign. They're talking about not only hunger in other countries like Biafra and all over, but that they're actually bringing it back home. It's a good thing. You know, I think that's something that's very important that may offset some of the things I was telling you about before, that the tightening, you know, the welfare laws. There's another article in this morning's paper saying in order for this state to get any more welfare money, they have to put together a program to find all those cheaters in the welfare. Has anybody ever tried to get welfare? Anybody here ever tried? I have. you have to bring your birth certificate. You have to bring the birth certificate of all your children. You have to bring your marriage certificate, your Social Security number. If you're a veteran, you have to bring those numbers. You have to bring your rent statements, a statement signed by your rent, the landlord. You know, and you have to bring your car payment book. If you're buying a car, you have to bring, what did I leave out? Oh, driver's license if you have one. Everything, you know, except short of a note from your parent. That's, you know, you've got to bring every kind of document. If you miss one of them, if you don't have the birth certificate of one of your kids because it was born in another state or something, or you've lost it, that's it. You got to come back another time and bring it. I mean, I guess I don't understand how too many people can cheat on that system. In fact, the biggest piece of fraud they found in the last couple of years in the welfare department was the workers. They were ripping off and they were cashing these checks in Wisconsin, South Dakota. They were flying back and forth between these different cities, putting money in all these different bank accounts, and it was, you know, like four workers. That was the welfare fraud in the state. So it's really hard. How about food stamps? Anybody try to get food stamps? Same thing. Now they're knocking out students. Students can no longer get food stamps, or at least they're trying to pass that legislation right now. That students and community organizers can no longer get food stamps because you cheat. You know, you're all up there cheating, we know it, or something like that. But see, now, why I bring that out and why I'm talking about it now is that all of that is related. Okay, that domestic hunger thing. One of the things we're trying to talk to the churches to do is to use the lobbying power, the legislative lobbying power that the churches have to offset that. Now, let's not talk about the cheaters. Let's talk about how many people, because they won't allow outreach, you know, so that people that don't get that stuff could actually, they don't even know they're eligible. But they're not talking about them. They're talking about the cheaters. So we're asking that the lobbyists, the churches use their people power to write letters and to bug the senators and everybody to talk about extending the benefits instead of catching all those, you know, cheaters. So trying to use everybody. Okay, Indian people are in the middle of all of this, you know. We're not just sitting back saying that, you know, well, our family life is really good and we know what it is and we know that, you know, what you are and what you've done. That's not true. You know, Indian people are really in there, hanging in there. Trying to change that system too. And in order to be able to live side by side, you know, with white people, Indian people also have to get involved. This is one of the ways that we see that we can get involved, you know, with everybody else. You know, we're talking about sharing and helping one another, and we found out a group now in the churches saying, well, they're talking about the same thing. They've been talking about it all along, but now they've got a coordinated effort that maybe we can change something. Okay, we see that as one place we can step in and help, maybe. Maybe we can all join forces on one thing or two things. I'm just bringing that as an example because it's sort of close to home. So, we're talking about family and talking about respect and talking about what Indian people see, you know, what Indian people see is good. We're not just leaving it there and then removing ourselves from society. But it means that, you know, that you learn to respect other people's dreams too and learn to try to work for them. It's really hard to do. This is a very hard concept to try and get across to anybody. For instance, that Alaskan pipeline, you know, that you all bought, you know, you bought all that land up there. You wiped out a whole bunch of reservations just recently called termination. Got a lot of money for it. That's what it says in the books, that they paid billions of dollars for the thing. Well, first of all, before you could pay anything, you had to register. The second thing you had to do, if anybody's ever seen pictures, has anybody been in Alaska? well, it's really something, you know. There's a town here and then a town over there and another little settlement over here and a little settlement over there. And maybe that settlement over there has a phone, you know. And they're all scattered. People talk different languages. You know, the different tribes up there speak different languages. And the white people speak even a different language. They speak the English. And everybody's all, you know, scattered. Their way of life is one of movement. You can't really grow too much on a patch of land in Alaska. So it's constant movement, you know, to find food. So it's that sort of a society. Now, 2 years ago, you bought all that land from the Indians up there. And you gave everybody 160 acres of land to live on. However, a couple of things happened. First, the Department of Natural Resources, DNR, got first choice of all the land. The pipeline got second choice of all the land. Then the Indians got it. Well, after all that division of land, most of what was left was glacier and mountaintops. Now, I don't know what you do with 160 acres of land of a mountaintop or of a glacier, you know, but that's what was left. I don't know what you do about feeding your family, you know. Well, they gave them a certain amount of money. I figure that money will last for about 7 years. And that's it. Then you're going to hear horror stories like you've never heard before. And you watch and see, because you did it. The family, you know, the thing was a sort of a mobile society. Now they're saying there's places that you can't go anymore, you know. They're beginning already not to have that mobility. Well, a lot of that money that was supposed to be paid said, well, we can't pay you until you become a township, because you're no longer a reservation. Okay, now they got to get that village and that little settlement and that little settlement and the one with the phone over there all together and make a township. Has anybody ever tried to incorporate anything? You ever done any kind of club or anything, try to incorporate anything? It took us 4 years to incorporate the Red Schoolhouse, and we started with an attorney. And they said that it had to be done that year. They said it in January. It had to be done by December 18th of that year, or they'd lose the money. And they all did. About three townships in there got some money. Where'd that money come from that you all paid to those natives up there, Native Americans? We know where that money came. They cut every single Indian budget in the United States, the lower 40, the Alaskans call it. They cut every single one of our budgets, our education budgets, our health budgets, every budget that we had, and the money went up there. In other words, you didn't pay a damn dime for it. We paid for it ourselves. The money was just transferred from the lower 40 to Alaska. So it was a ripoff. The land was stolen. You terminated a lot of tribes. Termination to a tribe means that they're dead. And it just takes a while to die. You watch, 6 or 7 years from now, we're trying to organize now, you know, to help those people. And the thing that we're trying to organize is that they can go back into tribal identity again. Maybe you should study a little about what happened in Menominee, Wisconsin, because the same thing happened there. And if you know what happened in Menominee, you'll understand what will happen there, only 10 times worse, because there isn't anything up there to work with. And the people are far removed from American society, yet that's what they're supposed to be living like. In order to, you know, I guess it's important that you understand that, because we're talking about, you know, what does a family mean? You know, what does that all have to do with family? But you have to understand that those are my brothers and my sisters up there. That the Hopi Indians in Southwest are feeling bad because that thing was terminated, and they're trying to figure out a way to help. You know, I'm telling you that family line doesn't just stop with brother and sister or third cousin, whatever a third cousin is. I don't know, I don't want to talk about it right now. But I mean, it's beyond that, you know. It's beyond what you call family. It extends everywhere and all around. We don't mind sharing our water if you will allow us to share it. I went to a reservation this summer. It was on the desert. It was a trip to be there in the summertime because it was 125 before 11:30 that morning. In the very southwestern corner of Arizona. And this little reservation was growing tomatoes under glass. They got all this glass. They got some kind of a grant and did it, which is cool. It's the best thing I ever saw. They had great big high tomato plants that they had grown under grass, under glass. And the thing about it was there was this river that was running through, and they were using that river to irrigate. And the river where we sat was about as wide as that one section there. And it sort of went around like this and everything. But there was this big, big, big area. And they said, that's where the river was. And I said, oh, that was cool, you know, and they had a jail there, an old frontier jail. And it was like a big prison was what it was. And I refused to go through it, but they were telling me, the other people that went through it said that there was you know, where you get hung on a wall with chains and stuff like that, the whole thing. But it was on the banks of this raging river, and they figured if they could get over there, they couldn't get anywhere anyway, because there was a cliff on one side and a river on the other side. And I thought, why are they worried about that little bitty river, you know? But our guide, who was about 35, 36 years old, remembered when the river, you know, was 15 times that large. You know, but what got in its way was Las Vegas, you know, good old fun Las Vegas, those Reno, all this water was being channeled to all these very necessary things, you know, however necessary you feel Las Vegas is to the United States, you know, community. And these people had that was their water, and it was no longer there. So that little tribe, who's growing tomatoes and selling them like mad, is worried because they're trying to get some more water off them. And so they're in court fighting all of that. But all of that sort of ties in with one to the other, and that's why I brought that newspaper along. You know, what has that newspaper got to do with anything except that's one of our connections between all of us who are in a family. My brothers and sisters on the Mohawk Reservation that write that letter, you know, the White Roots of Peace, and you'll be hearing from them if you show up for that one. But everything is connected because everybody's part of the family. I'm not down here speaking because of the wonderful salary you all are giving me. It's more than that. It's talking about, you know, you're part of the family too. And you have to understand that. And you have to begin to learn, share respect like everybody else does, like we do. Or we're all lost. That water question is very important. It will be very important in the next couple of years because they're going to try and wipe us out on that. The strip mining, you hear people talk about the strip mining coming in the next couple of days, or the next couple of weeks. I guess it's one thing to share, but it's another thing to be ripped off all the time. We're also saying that as a family, that we're standing up together. You know, the Hopis, the Navajo, all the way to the Mohawks, Chippewa, Sioux, and everybody are standing up saying, well, You know, if you're going to talk about strip mining, you're going to have to talk to all of us now. You know, we're all part of a family. So that family thing is just bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's not really, you know, I'm trying to explain it, that the thing, it's not growing. That's how big it always ever was, you see. And that's how everything, and that's why I keep, well, you know, I can't relate it to just the family circle. I can't, you know, we can get back to that, but it's all part of it, that the family is everything and everybody. And you, if you learn to respect that child I was talking about, and learn to respect the grandparents, and learn to respect the teenagers, and what they've got to say, you know, and learn to respect the parents, that you've got something, but it goes beyond that. You know, you have to learn to respect, you know, whoever. Any other questions?
Yeah, I was curious about the idea of being able to travel from one tribe to another and feel secure. Apparently, this is something that has developed in, say, 20th century, at least historically, there used to be a good deal of enmity among tribes in the state of Minnesota, the enmity between Sioux and Chippewa.
Well,
I doubt that Indian children would feel secure in traveling from one tribe to another in that earlier era, say the early 19th century.
Well, you're right.
There was raiding, of course.
Yeah, you're right. It was very hard to travel then. But push it back another 300 years when we were, you know, and we tease the Sioux continually about this, Chippewas always do, we always say, well, we kicked you out of the United, you know, we kicked you out of Minnesota, you know, which is sort of true. But the thing was that we were being pushed, you know. That as white men came across, you know, they just continually pushed and continually pushed, which meant that all of us were pushing into everybody else's territory. Then became the fights. That there wasn't, you know, there was raiding back and forth, but there wasn't the total hatred that almost grew because of being pushed into one another's territory. In the early 1900, the early 1600, 1700, 1800, on, you know, that push was being felt, and we're being forced, you know, into one another's territory.